Jerry, it's good to be back in the same room with you again. Last time we spoke, you were here at Safeco Field. I was in New York, and I've got a great story for you from my time in New York that pertains to the podcast.
Fire away. I'm all ears.
So Saturday night, I was getting a late dinner with a friend of mine who happens to be a scout for the Rays, and he had with him a friend who is a scout for the Brewers who I was meeting for the first time, a really good dude. And we're talking all things baseball for like hours, right? And Jason, my friend with the Rays, after 2 hours says, hey, man, the podcast is really great. And I said, oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, it was really a lot of fun. And then Jason said, your name, referenced DePoto and as it pertains to the podcast. And the other guy, the Brewer Scout, said, wait, you're the host of the DePoto podcast?
That's right.
A little more street cred. So just so you know, that this is making its way around all the hallways of Major League offices.
So it obviously, play-by-play on Root Sports, it's providing guidance to a nation at various national,
I would say,
sports
so
broadcasts, and this is what you're known for.
That's what I'm known for. Yeah. So I'm curious, after I got that feedback from a complete, essentially stranger hours beforehand, it made me think, has Jerry gotten any feedback from people of your level, other executives for other teams?
I have received an occasional, let's call it, sarcastic text.
Or
reference to actually, there have been a number of people in the industry who've reached out, and they think it's fun, they think it's informative, they enjoy listening to it. Oddly enough, I think many of the people in our organization, in the mm-hmm. Mariners organization, they're dialed in, they listen.
Sure.
And it's been refreshing for me to hear from them hopefully, whether it be the way I interact with my family at home, the way I interact with the people here at work, or the way we talk here on the podcast, I'm the same. And,
sure.
And the message is consistent, and I think that at least the feedback I'm getting is that's true. Unless they may not think that, but they tell me that.
Well, it's cool that you're getting we're only 9 episodes in as of today, so I'm sure that more feedback from I'm excited for when Sandy Alderson texts you with as he goes back and listens to the whole archives and hears the Alderson episode, right?
I'm sure that will eventually happen. I'm still waiting for that text to arrive, but
well, hey, speaking of the podcast, so remember you can always subscribe via iTunes if you have not already, and we're also on TuneIn for Android users, so good stuff there as Colin O'Keefe has continued to get this out to the masses. We've got a number of things to talk about today, Jerry, and one of the things that I was thinking about the other day as it pertains to our conversations, we talk all the time about analytics and how you use them, how the Mariners use them, and I was curious if you had spoken to people in your chair with other sports and other leagues, and if they have picked your brain about how you and the Mariners use analytics in basketball or in football or in hockey or whatever it might be.
The answer is yes. The short, I belong to a group. Well, we with the Mariners have an existing relationship with a group called Leaders in Sport, who they do a fantastic job of connecting various leaders throughout or crossing over the different divisions of sport. And in being involved with that group, I've been able to befriend a number of people in a variety of different sports, ranging from domestic U.S. sports like the NHL, the NBA, and the NFL, and sharing best practices with them, in addition to some maybe off-the-beaten-path opportunities, like particular European soccer, Australian rules football, the relationships we're able to build in those areas. And I've actually found myself over the last year or so starting to tune in to rugby matches because I really like the people that we've had an opportunity to interact with. So on to maybe the most unique of the people I've had a chance to get to meet is the captain of a cycling team, which is the never even knew that there would be a captain of a cycling team, the equivalent of a general manager, for a Tour de France cycling team. They specialize and they win the championship frequently. And, I think the opportunity to talk with people who build teams in these variety of different sports, the way they put together rosters and the needs they have, the the ability to be a teammate and rely on one another is consistent across all sports. Mm. They just may look through a different analytical lens.
It's interesting, like, and you look at, I mean, college basketball is in full swing, of course, right now with conference play, the NBA, the NHL, as you were just referencing briefly. You know, like, Ken Pom has kind of become that guy for college hoops, right? I mean, he has built an empire on basically the number nerds for college basketball, and it seems like that is obviously infiltrating the NBA as well. But does baseball have the leading edge when it comes to that type of thing?
Yeah, I think most in the world of analytics and sports, metrics, believe that baseball is the forerunner. I know this dates back, again, we'll reference Sandy Alderson, Billy Beane, Theo Epstein, coming through the last 25 years or so, where it's become so much more fashionable. Baseball is viewed as the worldwide leader in sport in the collection of and dissemination of application of analytics using the metrics to make a difference, whether it's in how we set up our defenses, this is how we evaluate our players, or the like. We are, in fact, maybe viewed as the trailer or, you know, bringing up the rear in regard to high performance. And part of what we trade out is, you know, we will have multiple in-depth conversations, sometimes daily meetings. I'm going for a pair of them at the end of this month with a couple of NBA teams, where we will do an information share. We will provide them with insight for how we use and gather the analytics and apply it, and maybe the way we scout, which is much, much different than other sports. And in return, we will get a ton of information on high performance, on player care, rest and recovery, which is obviously, as you know, an avenue we're currently traveling, trying to figure out how to become something less than the 30th dog in the race.
So, I mean, this is obvious and it goes without saying, but in case people haven't heard some of our previous episodes, like Sandy, I mean, that's where Dr. Lorena Martin comes in, right? This is a groundbreaking effort on your part to have a person who is the focal point of that position.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And Lorraine is brilliant. And we know that transitioning and as a baseball team into an area where really no baseball teams have crossed, it's a big undertaking. And we're going to run into some bumps in the road. We're hopeful that it manifests itself in a big 2018 result. But we might see this over the course of time as we develop these plans, process, and applications. But so far, so good. The impact that Lorena has had with our major league staff, the buy-in that she's achieved in our big league clubhouse, so to speak, and with the connection she's made with our players, right now we're moving in a very positive direction. We've got a lot of developmental work to do in the other areas of the organization. But right now, so far, so good is the way to term our HP.
Along those lines, in some ways, this is kind of the time of year where people like to make projections of what each team will look like, and FanGraphs certainly has no shortage of those numbers. Is that something that you and your office pay attention to?
Absolutely. There's religiously is the answer.
Really?
I can't wait till the next projection comes out. It's almost like a kid. When you were a kid and you were going to the drugstore, the candy store to get a pack of baseball cards at the start of the season, dying to see, you know, what the new edition looked like or who was going to be on top of the cellophane pack. You know, I feel the same way in this stage of my life looking for projections, because what it does is it generally expresses, while they may not be accurate with our own line of thinking, while they may not be consistent with whatever projections we're producing internally, they are reflective. If you take Baseball Reference, if you take Prospectus, if you take FanGraphs, and you take a collective view of them, you know, effectively throw them into a hopper and divide by five, you get a general idea of what the state of your club is, where the strengths are and where the weaknesses are. And, you know, to that extent, it's pretty consistent with our own vision of our team. We believe we have a good offensive club. It's represented that way. We believe we have a deep and quality bullpen. It is represented that way. We believe that we have some questions in our starting rotation, and we need to prove that we're healthy enough to maintain the long road, and that's represented in the forecast, regardless of whether you agree with the decimal points.
Do you ever have a time where you say to somebody in the office, okay, did you see this one? Can you believe that they wrote this?
A whole day.
And then are there times where you say, I think they're absolutely spot on? Or I'm guessing, is it normally more times someplace in the middle?
I would say more often than not, it's the we all. And when I say we all, not just the Mariners, but 30 teams. I've worked for a handful over the course of my lifetime. We all believe our players are better than anybody else believes our players are. And that goes from scouting and player development through your major league club building. There are exceptions to the rule. Everybody knows the greatness of Mike Trout or Bryce Harper or Manny Machado or Josh Donaldson. We all look at our role players, or what we would call the contributors, not the stars, or the average everyday player who doesn't really grab the marquee, or doesn't, you know, isn't a known entity in the public eye. We all hold those players in such a much different light than what they do in a projection system, or what the other 29 teams do. So, you know, we have a favorable view of those guys, and we always think they're getting hosed when we look at the Fangraphs projections. That's just real.
Sure.
You know, so, you know, because we have a greater feel for what that person, not necessarily what the player's statistical review is, but what the person, what his work habits, what his internal development, what his physical changes look like. And as a result, you know, for instance, I think the this year's projections, particularly those on Fangraphs, we're a little light on a variety of our players, not the least of which are Gene Segura, Mitch Haniger, and maybe most notably, D. Gordon. And some of that is natural. It's hard to divide by three when there's been broken service or in essence, no service, and you're trying to work off of one short number. You know, I can't fault them for questioning our starting pitching. We know we're going to have to prove it. But I think our lineup has proven their mettle, and they deserve a little more credit than they're getting.
So how do you, in your position, go about not falling in love too much with any player? Because when you first came to the Mariners and Trader Jerry was born, right? I mean, let's face it, maybe exclusively the players that you were trading away, they weren't quote-unquote your players, right? You inherited these players. And I think a lot of us thought, well, it's got to be a lot easier to trade away a player that you did not help to cultivate. Well, now you've been with the Mariners for long enough that that's not the case, right? Most of these players are your players. So how do you go about balancing that kind of love for a player almost like a child, right? But being able to see where the team can be better in some areas.
The easy answer to that is there's in roster building or even in assessment, there's kind of three ways you can look at it. You can look at it optimistically, you can look at it pessimistically, or you can look at it pragmatically. And this one I've presented to our scouting group, I've presented it to our player development group. I am a pragmatist. That's what I do. We identify a problem, and then we're looking for a logical solution. How do we fill that hole? And what you're doing in filling that hole is looking at a bigger picture where we can't allow the group or we can't allow our army to be brought down by the one individual. And when I say by the one individual, we're never going to leave one out on the battlefield, but we may need to trade one to make sure that the others can better perform in the right way, if that makes any sense. We want to create a group, a unit that can go 162 games and come out on top. And sometimes that may not include a player that we're all emotionally attached to. A great example is this past offseason. We may not have had a player in the last 2 years who I like personally any more than Emilio Pagan. He's a terrific guy. I like him. I like his family. I love the way he's wired. He's a hard worker. And I think he's a really good major league reliever. But there's a really good major league reliever doesn't play first base, you know, and so we had to, you know, we had to come up with an alternative solution. And while we have other players that I like and believe are really good major league relievers, Dan Altavilla, newly acquired Sean Armstrong, Nick Rumbelow, James Pazos, we have a number of guys that we feel like can really contribute. Tony Zick are all in that general genre. Optionable, controllable, young relievers with big arms. It was an area where we thought we had a surplus. We're going to use pragmatically. We're going to use it to solve a problem without allowing the emotion to pull us down. And then later on, when Emilio Pagan succeeds, I will be the first one he gets a text from to congratulate him on his success.
He mentioned scouting a moment ago. Do I understand correctly that there is a scouting meeting of some kind going on at Safeco Field as we speak?
Yeah, you've pulled me away. The 45 minutes we had to wait for Nathan to fix the audio, you know. But no, we are currently conducting our scouting meetings. You know, this past week we went through a continued education program down in Peoria with our high performance and player development camp. the week prior we did our major league staff. So this is, we call it Kumbaya Month. You know, we go through a series of meetings, first with our major league group, then with our player development group, then with our scouting group, to essentially refocus ourselves. Here's what we're about. We identify the pecking order of I guess priorities in each of those departments, and effectively bring them up to date on what we're doing organizationally, so that we all move better in unison. And it's wildly productive. In some cases, it's our only chance to get to sit live with some of the people, especially area scouts, who aren't frequently in Seattle. So it gives us a chance face-to-face to see what they're about, to let them contribute in a more meaningful way. And I think as far as meetings go and party planning, organizing, few people do it better than our VP of Scouting, Tom Allison, who is he's a master of creating a flow in a day and keeping it interesting for everybody. And I think we're making progress, and we're having a little bit of fun.
Tommy's wonderful. What a good dude. How many scouts are we talking about that come to meetings like this? How many people?
I'm in a ballpark and say downstairs we've probably got something in the neighborhood of 60. And, and that includes leadership, cross-checkers, area scouts, professional scouts, and a few of our international personnel, in addition to our analysts front office who are down there contributing to taking a look through different lenses. So, you know, we scout players in a variety of different ways to come to a conclusion. It's almost like a scouting pinwheel now with the player at the center. So analytics, it's performance, it's the scouting view, it's makeup, it's the high performance group and their assessment of psychology, the psychology of the player, the character of the player. And we're taking all that information and trying to I guess massage it into the right decision making formula, so to speak.
And are we at a level now, this time of baseball, where you can get that much information on an amateur player?
Holy smokes, yes, to the point where, you know, in some cases, it's almost information overload. And by the time you get to the June draft particularly, you can almost talk yourself out of a player because you know too much, which is because in many cases, these players are being scouted shortly after they're leaving grade school.
Sure.
So we know, particularly in the baseball hotbeds, you know, Florida, California, Texas, even now I would qualify Georgia as the big four. And I don't know that anybody's ever thrown Georgia out there, but that is
really,
Georgia is its own scouting mecca, and particularly at the high school level. But those four spots, because the weather is conducive to year-round baseball, and we have so many good young players coming out of those places, and particularly in the cases of California, Florida, and Georgia, there are amateur tournaments going on there year-round for players age 9 to 18, and we're watching all of them. So in some cases, we may be watching a prospective first-rounder for 2018 who we've seen play since age 10 or 12, which is, it's good that you know that much about them. It's also bad that you know that much about them. And, you know, we're trying to stay level-headed and make good decisions, but it's, you know, this is the information age, and we've got a ton of it.
Hey, last time we spoke, Jerry, you were hours away from departing to Clinton, Iowa. How was your time with the good folks with the Lumber Kings?
The time with the good folks was fantastic. We had a group, I would say, of about 120 Lumber King loyalists. Many of whom, as I have found out, are on the board of directors, which numbers 25. Like the Green Bay Packers, the Clinton Lumber Kings are a community-owned franchise. And I have to say they're our affiliate, and I did not know that until this weekend. And, you know, Ted Turno, the general manager in Clinton, filled me in on the detail, and I thought it was great. We had a nice dinner. It was an adventurous journey to and fro. and I will say the fro is a little bit more ominous than the two. But in getting to Clinton, I would say the temperature was roughly around zero. The snow was heavy. And for those NFL films enthusiasts, I was in my head, I was the whole thing was being narrated by John Facenda as I looked out windows and made my way from door to door.
Well, I'm glad that you made it there and back all right, and I'm sure the good folks at Clinton enjoyed having you. And I did not know that either about the Lumber Kings. So I'm sure that will make a broadcast at some point, so I thank you for that.
That's great.
Hey, speaking of the NFL, and obviously the playoffs are deep right now, I've been told about a flag football adventure of yours when you were with the Rockies? Can you shed some light on this?
It is something I recently shared with my good friend Kevin Martinez, who we are all fond of, and he thought it would be fun to allude to it somewhere in this process. But in the 1990s, I played for the Rockies from 1997 and retired in 2000. And if you'll recall, that was a time for Colorado where the Broncos were two-time Super Bowl champs, the Avalanche were two-time Stanley Cup champs, and it was, whether it's John Elway or Terrell Davis or a host of Hockey Hall of Famers, you know, we had the MVP of the National League in Larry Walker in 97 and maybe the biggest young hitting star of the late 90s in Todd Helton. And it was just a host of – it was a great time to be a sports fan in Denver. Well, I bought a house in Denver in the fall of 1997, and only after moving in did I realize that we lived on a street with what I would say were no less than five NHL All-Stars. And, you know, one lived catty-corner to me, one lived across the street, another lived at the end of the street. Guys like Adam Foote and Keith Jones and Joe Sakic, and, you know, at a time where these guys were at the top of their game. And and catty corner to us lived a couple of young guys, 16 and 11-year-old brothers named Matt and Ryan Schick. And Matt, who's now working for ESPNU, I believe, as trying to summon his inner Aaron Goldsmith.
We'll have to get a podcast first.
Yeah, there you go. That's right. And, you know, a 16 and 11-year-old, this almost harkens back to the days of Willie Mays playing stickball without the fanfare of actually having Willie Mays with a stickball. So, you know, I walked out on a sunny, you know, Thursday afternoon in November, and, you know, I learned a lot about the hockey schedule. You know, the guys go over to the arena, they do a skate around for a little bit of time in the mornings, go through their treatments, and then come back home, and then they go back down to the rink about an hour before the game. All right. So it's a different rhythm than the baseball schedule. So as it worked out, and I can say this now because they're all retired and they won't get in trouble for me calling them out on the air, but I walked out and started playing catch with the football with the two boys, you know, Matt and Ryan, and next thing you know, Adam Foote filtered out of his house and Keith filtered out of his house, and before long we had a full-fledged like 3-on-3 going, just playing football. And, you know, the following weekend a couple of my teammates were over the house watching a football game, and the same thing, we naturally gravitated out to the street. Well, before long we start playing like organized flag football games with the two neighborhood kids as the captains of teams, and one is the captain of a team of Rockies players and the other is a captain of a team of Avalanche players. And let's just say we found out quickly that the Avs guys, while wonderful hockey players and all-stars in their own right, Stanley Cup champs, were not fleet of foot on the ground. And as a result, we were able to expose a weakness and you know, scored some quick touchdowns, and we won a handful of games right out of the chute. Only after identifying that we had come up with a weakness and we had an 11-year-old bomber tossing up 7-yard passes after we got in back of him that resulted in touchdowns.
And Tommy John.
Yes. So only after this was identified did they change their tact. And, you know, on a given play and at the start of, let's call it game number 6 of this succession, I'm lined up to go out, and Adam Foote, all-star, many-time all-star in the NHL as a defenseman for the Avs, later the Columbus Blue Jackets. I took 3 steps off the line, and then I was laying on my back in the middle of –
Is this within the rules?
In our rules. So it was within our rules. I am laying on the ground, staring up at the air, and I looked at Adam, and I said – the hell. and he said, hey, we learned our lesson. It's go time, and it's on. That was the first time we lost.
Really?
Because roughly we found out that they were much tougher than we were. And we couldn't get off the line, and it turned into more like a John Facenda grinder at the Ice Bowl. And we played those games for about 3 years.
Really?
Yeah, 3 years. It was fantastic. The kids throughout the time, Matt went off to college, Ryan went into high school. And then ultimately Keith Jones was traded to the Flyers, and the group started to break up a little bit. You know, Joe Sakic, you know, moved to a bigger house. And the rest of us, we had a lot of fun. We played with it was interactive. The kids in the neighborhood, people would gravitate out toward the street. They would laugh at how maniacal quickly we were going after this. And, you know, it's 20 some odd years ago, but I've never forgotten how fun it was and how engaging it was. And really, that looking back on the moment, what it must have meant for those kids to have that kind of interaction with the guys. And believe me, not me and our utility infielder, but the when I say this, I mean like true hockey legends and watching them throw a football around and run around like madmen trying to pull socks out of the belt of the, you know, the crazy baseball players who could throw it a long way but couldn't get off the ground.
So high budget flag football is what you're saying.
It
with
was.
The socks.
I mean, God, if anybody went down, we were all in trouble.
So would you be okay if three of your players played flag football against NHL All-Stars?
I may have something to contribute to that. I think it would be a horrible decision. But one of the things, and Scott and I always talk about it, is that just like we are as parents, and you think about all the stupid things that you did when you were growing up, and the best you can do is impart on your kids, you know, do as I do, not as I say, or do as I say, not as I do type thing. But I will say this, that, and we say it to our players all the time, and to some degree I've taken a little bit of ribbing from the players about it. I always reference it. Find a way to say yes. Find a way to say yes to the request. Find a way to say yes to the autograph. Find a way to say yes to interacting in your community. And that's just part of it. It's finding a way to connect. We don't need to run around like madmen throwing footballs around, but, you know, who among us hasn't done something that we regret years later?
Sure. This does lead to the never-ending debate as to who is the best athlete among all the professional sports.
Oh, my God. I have opinions. If I had to pick a single player in a single sport, I'll take the cornerback in the NFL as the best athlete in sports. If you think about it, they're super athletes. They have the skills and athleticism of a wide receiver. Only they're playing their position running backwards. there's each sport is unique unto itself. Mm-hmm. And I've referenced this before, Aaron. One of the reasons why I think baseball is such a passionate thing for the fan base is that most people that love the game or that watch the game in some way have taken part in the game. They've played catch. They've played Little League. They played softball. They've taken a whack with the wiffle ball. You know, they've done something. And when you watch the major league player on a major league field, it looks just like it looked when you were doing it. Only it's happening a lot faster. And you know, but the result is that most people who watch and are fans of the game think they're not too far removed from playing the game at that level. I'll tell you another story about that somewhere along the way. If you want to do it now, I will.
Yes.
Right? So in 1994. 1994, I was with the Cleveland Indians, and we were in the midst of, as we know, the Major League Baseball players' strike. Mm-hmm. And you recall, we went home, I think it was August 11th or 12th of that year, not expecting that the World Series would be canceled and that the rest of the season was forfeit. We went home with the idea that we were going to keep ourselves in shape for when they called and we were going back. So we would get together in the mornings. We would go work out. At the time, I was living in Kansas City. We would go work out, we'd throw, and there were a dozen players that would come and gather in the mornings to go through this that lived in suburban Kansas City. Off the top of my head, Joe Carter, Kevin Seitzer, Mike McFarlane, and Brian McCray. It was good group, really talented players. And George Brett, the great Hall of Famer for the Royals, who had retired the year before, would still come out occasionally and just generally join in the workout, the banter.
Sure.
And he had a friend who he introduced us all to, a guy by the name of Lee Judge. And I'd met Lee. He was a cartoonist for the Kansas City Star. He was also the manager, first baseman / DH for a local 35 and over men's league team. Long and short, after many weeks of discussion, Lee had surmised that his 35 and older team was of the belief that they were somewhere between AAA and major league quality play, and he was curious if we weren't busy on a given night, if we could play them in an exhibition game, and he wasn't going to tell them who we were or what we were doing. They were just going to show up and play an exhibition game, you know, off-schedule game. We showed up in sweatpants and T-shirts, and when the team took the field, it was like an all-star team of players on the field. And I'm literally at that time, think of how good those players were. Seitzer and McFarland, oh, yeah, and Joe Carter, you know, BMAC. So everybody lines up on the field, and immediately, and most notably, they recognize Joe Carter. Immediately, the group of 35 to 45-year-old men in the other dugout, hold on, there's something wrong here. We proceeded to play what was going to be a regulation game. We all agreed we batted opposite hand. We batted opposite hand.
It's a pretty big handicap.
And at the end of two innings, we were winning the game 16-0.
Oh.
And they had not made contact in the batter's box. Finally, we called off the jam. Everybody got together for a group photo afterward. And I think they understood at that time that the game does move a little bit quicker with that type of player.
That's fantastic.
All kinds. Keep going.
That's when you mentioned the Rockies, it did, in a roundabout way, remind me of something I've been meaning to ask you for a while. A regular listener of the podcast, the great Mark Simon of ESPN, he was part of their ESPN Stats and Info department, and he does such a great job. He even came on air with us a couple of spring trainings ago when he was down in Peoria. We like Mark a lot. He reached out to me at this point months ago. Sorry, Mark. And he had a bit of trivia for me. And I'm sure you know the answer to this, Jerry, but I have to ask you anyway.
Don't be sure.
Well, you've faced Hall of Famers, of course, over the course of your career. In fact, Hall of Fame hitters logged 113 at-bats against you.
Not good for me, I'm sure.
Well, you're always very self-deprecating with your career, but I've got this one for you. Of those 113 at-bats against current Major League Hall of Famers, only one hit a home run off of you.
One Hall of Famer hit a home run off me.
Do you know who that is?
One Hall of Famer. If I had to pick the one.
You were with the Rockies.
I was with the Rockies, and I gave up a home run to a future Hall of Famer.
Correct.
I will say that the one thing I will not be super self-deprecating about is I didn't give up a ton of homers. That
All
was
right.
I didn't accrue a ton of strikeouts. I had to give something to get something.
Well, he's a somewhat recent member of
could
Cooperstown.
It have been? I know the players that I faced the most, the Hall of Famers that I faced the most were, I'm going to go off on a tangent here and say, okay, it just struck me, hanging slider right center field, could it possibly have been Craig Biggio?
You nailed it.
Yeah.
You can still see that pitch?
I can see it, largely because as we talked on a past podcast,
right?
I very kind of collector centric, memorabilia centric,
mm-hmm,
and shortly after giving up that bomb to Craig Biggio, I received an 8x10 signed photo from said Hall of Famer that was signed, "Quit throwing me that nasty slider."
Are you serious?
Craig Biggio. Go get him. Yeah. And then, I still have it. I kept it. And it's in a book. It's because I found it comical. It was, I think my slider was better than that one. But whether it's particularly the guys you faced a lot, Biggio, Bagwell, Mike Piazza, Barry Larkin, that I can think in that many at-bats, I didn't give up a ton of homers, but I threw a ton of sliders. And there was only one I remembered throwing to a player of that ilk that didn't come back, and that was the one.
So did you have some form of a relationship with Biggio at the time for him to send you that photo?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it wasn't.
That's
it wasn't
fantastic.
Accidental. And I think it was. He was put up to it by a teammate of mine, which was I thought funny and welcome.
And you're saying that is a piece of your collection you still have?
Definitely.
Yes, I would think so.
Yes.
Well, we'll get to some fan questions. Remember, you can always ask your question. You can email us thewheelhouse@mariners.com, thewheelhouse@mariners.com. This is a Tom from where you might have met Tom. He's in Clinton, Iowa, Jerry. First of all, he wants to thank you for coming out to the Hot Stove Banquet there, and he cites the not-so-warm weather there for you. And he is a big fan of the podcast, loves listening, especially enjoyed your memorabilia episode. His question for you is about the minor leagues and promotions and demotions throughout the farm systems. Specifically, what are your requirements for promoting or demoting a player, and do you think the Mariners promote fast enough? Apparently he lives close to the Astros single-A club, and he feels like those guys are moving up and down all the time, and that some have success with that and some don't. So your thoughts on how to promote players in the minor leagues?
Well, I think while we don't have a system, a metric that gives us a number to define when mm-hmm. the player gets promoted, we do have a criteria for advancement, but it changes for each player. each of our players in the system, when we get to spring training, will sit down with Andy McKay, with our coordinators, and with their individual affiliate managers, and they're going to go through an individual player plan. And each player is going to have a different plan. If we have five key points in their player plan that we'd like to see them achieve, when it's time for them to move is when they've shown that they've adequately nailed most of that list. And they know that. It could be four, it could be five, it's not going to be three. You'll stay at a level until you achieve the ability to succeed in whatever those instances are. And some of them might be as simple as throwing your slider for a strike 50% of the time. It might be 60% first pitch strikes. We'll create attainable, achievable goals and give them to players. We don't want to make it too subjective, because subjective goals create too much gray area. So we'll try to give them something. It usually references strike zone control. We're not looking for you to hit 20 homers to move. We're not looking for you to win an MVP to move, etc. But it's usually about controlling the strike zone on both sides of the ball.
Can you expand? What do you mean by creating the gray area exactly?
In a gray area, if we are too subjective in our goal setting or in our criteria mm-hmm. for advancement, then it comes down to opinion. Mm-hmm. And opinion is always going to create angst. And that you don't want the player to ever not have a black and white understanding of where he stands. So he always has the feedback of understanding what we think as a teammate, what we believe in his work habits, what we think of his focus and attentiveness. But if we give him, and in some cases it might be three bullets, or in some uh-huh. cases it might be five, we're going to give him three or five tangible, reachable goals. This is what you're trying to get to. And it's simple to look at the stat sheet and let that motivate you. That's the carrot. You can come. Everybody can work hard. Anybody we sign can and will and should work hard. Not everybody can throw 60% first pitch strikes. Not everybody can throw their slider over the plate 50% of the time. Not everybody can win the 1-1 count X percentage of the time, which is what we're trying to teach. Those are winning traits on the field, and when you do those things, you get to go to the next level.
Well, Jerry, believe it or not, we are just 4 weeks away from pitchers and catchers reporting, and on Thursday we'll be 10 weeks from opening night at Safeco Field. Hard to believe it's almost here. And remember, as always, you can get your tickets for opening day among every other game by simply going to Mariners.com or any Mariners team store. Jerry, I look forward to sometime seeing that Craig Biggio photo.
I would gladly bring it in. Well, hang it on the office wall. We could throw darts at it.
Thanks for the time, as always, man.
My pleasure.